Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I'm your host, Radu Palamariu, and it is my pleasure to have with us today Richard White, CEO of WiseTech Global, an innovative global developer of cloud-based software solutions for the international and domestic logistics industries. The company has over 12,000 logistics organizations using their software across 130 countries, and their flagship product, CargoWise One, provides a comprehensive end-to-end logistics solution and forms an integral link in the global supply chain. Richard, thank you for the time and pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. That was a great introduction.
My pleasure. Let's start firstly with yourself, because you have a fascinating story. So I was reading that when you started your career, you were a musician, you have a background in refrigeration, you're a refrigeration engineer, you did some computer wholesaling, and at some point you were repairing guitars for AC/DC and the Angels, and you built also the world's first digital lighting console. So how did you actually end up in the tech industry, and how did you end up doing tech for logistics, actually?
Well, it's a story of a development of knowledge and a career. I like discovering things and learning things. But I might take you back to the very beginning of that and just sort of walk you forward. I actually lived in a large piece of land with my grandparents and parents, and my grandfather and I, when I was named after my grandfather, and they ran a function center. And from the age of 12, I worked on a Friday and Saturday night washing dishes in a huge machine with, you know, the spinning rotary thing with dishes. And I remember at the age of 12, receiving these little brown paper envelopes with money in them on a Friday, which was my pay for the previous two Friday and Saturday nights. And that was the sort of beginning of my recognition of reward and effort. And I don't remember how much money I was paid, and I don't have any recollection of what I did with the money. But I remember feeling how proud and motivated I was that I was actually being rewarded for doing something which I quite enjoyed. And I went on to work through my grandparents' business, which I said was a function center, working as a waiter when I was 16, serving the guests and, you know, helping the bride and groom around and that sort of thing. And then at the age of 17, selling receptions. And that was a great experience. And I'm pretty sure my grandparents were sort of teaching me something and trying to get me to be entrepreneurial. My grandfather was a true entrepreneur. My grandmother was one of the hardest working people I've ever met. She just strived and made things work and kept the whole place running. So that was great to observe, and it was great to be part of that. Every school holiday while I was in high school, practically every school holiday, I went to my father's refrigeration factory, which is a very heavy engineering factory, and I would help him, and I would fix things, and I would learn to weld, and I'd learn to wire up the air conditioning units and do all sorts of clever things. And he was good. He was a very good engineer, and he did teach me about things, and we'd talk about Ohm's law, and we'd talk about, you know, how electricity works and all that sort of stuff. And I was a sponge for that sort of knowledge. And that gave me a skill with my hands. I could use my hands to make things with metal. About the age of 16, I started really becoming interested in guitar, and I practiced a lot, and I played a lot, and I became very keen on the idea of being a rock and roll star, I guess, a muser. And my father was pretty negative on that idea, but my talent was fairly obvious, and I won some talent contests and so forth. And so he said, well, as long as you do your trade certificate in refrigeration, I'm okay with you being a musician, which I did. I became a qualified refrigeration engineer a long time ago now. And by the age of 20, I was playing around the various places near my home in Sydney. And we were playing on stage as a backup act or as the main act with other bands. And that got me I met the Angels, and I'm still very good friends with Rick Brewster, who's one of the founders of the Angels, one of the Brewster brothers. And I met Angus and Malcolm sort of backstage, and I showed them how I'd set my guitar up, and they said, oh, can you do that for us? So I ended up talking to lots of people, and I realized that music was a lot of fun, but it was a terribly unrewarding industry, and there was a lot of charlatans and sort of crooks and bad people in music. So I decided that I would much rather be economically sustainable than I was interested in being a rock and roll star. So I opened up a business repairing musical instruments. And I taught myself, you know, sort of from books and some observations at how to do things. It became very popular. I did most of the big bands in Australia, the Cold Chisel, the Angels, AC/DC, many other players. And because I could play, but I could also do things mechanically, electrically, and sort of physically. And I ran that business for a number of years, and it was it grew as a business, and we had a great reputation. I was given a premises in town next to one of the big guitar stores, and I even did Carlos Santana's work while he was touring. But I realized that after a few years that the whole business was based on my hands, my talent, the things that I could do with my hands and my fingers. And I can't scale that. I had two hands, but I couldn't really delegate that to somebody else and trust the quality of their workmanship. So I ended up selling that business profitably, and it was a profitable business while I was doing it. So again, there was this entrepreneurial thing coming through, and I sold that to one of my co-workers, and I started building lighting equipment. This was more physical. It was something that was more industrialized, and I built lighting stands and trusses and specialized lighting equipment. And I actually built some very specialized lighting, which became a very popular thing worldwide, called a Ray lamp. It was named after one of the lighting directors for the Angels, a guy called Ray Hawkins. And it became a sort of a famous lighting fixture because of a very unique beam. These days it's all LED, so it's a bit different now. But back then it was very, very striking. And I then merged that company with a company called Jans, who was a provider of concert production services, and I became the R&D manager. And again, set out to take the lighting equipment thing further. I became a shareholder of Jans, and I became the R&D manager, and I ran a number of engineers, and they were doing very clever things with electronics. And so I basically started reading about digital electronics. They were all analog engineers, and I basically wanted to build a computerized system. I ended up building a prototype using what back then was very powerful computing, huge amounts of memory, which today is less computer power than in my Apple Watch, but back then it was huge. And in 1984, we released the first truly digital lighting console, in a very lightweight, very powerful scene controller, all those sort of things. And having done that, I kind of had learned computing. I taught myself assembler and C++ and C, and I decided that those talents were more important than the sort of lighting. So I sold my shares in the business back to the other founders, and I started delving into computer software, sort of stumbling around trying to figure out how that worked. I also built a wholesale computer business at the time, selling Philips monitors and Unisys computers and other things. But that business was not that much fun because it was a buy-sell business. I would buy something, you'd make a margin to sell it. So I didn't think that was very interesting, but I really thought the software development was really interesting. And I sold that business. So by now I'm sort of three or four businesses into my business career. None of them were incredibly successful, but they were all successful enough. And then I sold that business. I started consulting on software, and I stumbled across a number of freight forwarders who had a real need for decent software and decent databases and decent sort of functional systems. And they had lots of little tiny systems that did bits and pieces, but there was nothing holistic, nothing integrated, nothing fundamental. And so I started envisaging this idea and thinking I knew that there was a problem, but I didn't quite know what the solution was. I then got a contract building a logistics fulfillment system in the US, and that was sort of the start of my coding of logistics software. And I went to that was a six-month contract. I finished that. I came back to Australia, and I started writing a system for freight forwarding and customs. My CTO, Brett, joined me in 1993. And in 1994, we released the first production version of a product called Deliverance, and we founded WiseTech Global that year. And the rest, they say, is history.
Wow. It's incredible. I didn't know. I mean, thank you for sharing and walking us through the history. And it's interesting, the pattern of you starting up businesses, how it ran in the family. I've had one or two other guests on the podcast, and it's interesting how all that family type of foundational and fundamental salesmanship and entrepreneurial spirit can shape people. And it's also interesting that within your story, and there's a couple of other entrepreneurs right now trying to do different things in the logistics industry, but there seems to also be a pattern that they're not necessarily from logistics. So just like yourself, you kind of came across it not necessarily by by rational or logical. You kind of stumbled across it. That also seems to be interesting, right? Because it is definitely an industry that needs to be fixed, or that needs. There's a lot of improvements to be done. I think CargoWise has been an incredibly powerful tool to do that. And I was actually curious because you've seen the development in this in the evolvement of the industry from the 90s and to where it is today. Where do you still see that it needs to improve in the next couple of years?
I think the first thing to think about is where the industry came from or why it has a problem, and what those problems are. It falls very smoothly from that once you understand it. So the industry came of age after the Second World War, and of course, no sort of computer technology existed in those early years. And even through the 70s and 80s, when technology was starting to become more mainstream, it wasn't at a power or a level that could actually run a global company. There were some little systems that would run in single offices. There was no connectivity. There was no internet. And so, and for efficiency reasons, the industry developed a number of practices and processes, and I guess you could call them fragments. You can think about this, you know, there's a stevedore, there's landside logistics container haulage, there's container pack and unpack depots, there's empty container parks, there's customs brokers, there's freight forwarders, there's a variety of other, you know, people like fumigation for biosecurity, customs inspection. There's a whole range of things. It became very, and then obviously road transport, and there's many forms of road transport, airlines, shipping lines, rail. This is a very complex sort of Lego set of bits and pieces, and all of them were fragments of the total solution, because anybody that moves goods either domestically or globally has to move through multiple components of a system. And in those days, those components were not connected. And in order to make it work, the world of logistics built various workarounds because they didn't have the technology links like a true digital complete database and a true linked system, sort of straight through processing. So you'd have things like buffers for time and buffers for space, like a container park is kind of a buffer that allows the landside logistics to work. And, you know, shipping lines have to hold lots and lots of containers. They can't maximize the utility of those because it's hard to plan without a complete data set. And there are many other examples of where the highly specialized nature of these fragments of the logistics system and the fact that they weren't connected because there was no connectivity in the beginning evolved into disconnected businesses that didn't talk to each other than through paper. And even though paper is no longer the primary driver of communications, it's now digital paper. So it's now a PDF, an e-paper. So we didn't move to data. We moved from printed paper to electronic paper. And, you know, people say, put data in a system, perhaps, you know, typing it in. Then they print a document like a PDF and send that document electronically to the next person, who then reads the document, types that into the next fragment system. And then they put it in their system. They print another document to the next party, who then read that document, put it in. And so this goes into data, out of data, into data, out of data, you know, rekeyed, taken out, rekeyed, taken out, rekeyed, taken out. And, of course, that's an incredibly efficient system. And each of those rekeys and removal of the data, or adding and taking the data out, is a kind of a little barrier, and you can't see through them. You can't have a through system. There is no true connectivity. If you think of other electronic systems that have evolved further, like I think of a stock exchange and a trading system for a stock exchange. It used to be open outcry, people running around with bits of paper, screaming at each other and, you know, bidding prices on shares. It's now computer trading. And in fact, in those systems where there is a completely straight-through process and it's all digital, computer trading can happen in milliseconds. and can be seen from end to end, and the settlement's completely electronic, and the delivery of the stock is electronic, and it's held electronically. That's a true straight through digital system. We don't have that in logistics, and we've lived with those disconnected fragments. What CargoWise has done, what CargoWise One has done, is really it's taken a number of those fragmented pieces, particularly around freight forwarding and the handling of international and customs and the landside pieces, and it's joined them together in a digital system that is able to do straight-through processing. So the documents themselves don't have to come out of the system and go back in again and come out and go back in again. Literally, the data itself drives the system completely. Now, we're not done with that, and that's just a part of the problem, but that's the fundamental problem. Everything is kind of disconnected, even though it's linked together with electronic paper. That's not a very efficient system. It needs to be a digital system. It needs to be digital data straight through processing, and documents shouldn't be rekeyed by every party. They should arrive as data and leave as data. And then you can see the path through all the systems, and things like the shipper can see all of the events and all of the visibility as their goods move towards their customer. And the customer can see the same thing coming in the other direction. And all the parties in the middle have the same data, even though they might be adding little bits of information as they pass through a customs border or get a clearance or get a fumigation or whatever it is. But the fundamental thing is it's an additive process, not a rekeying process, not a repetitive rekeying process. It means that the data's clean. It never has entered correctly the first time. It never changes. It only gets added to. Very powerful. But we're not there yet. There's a lot to do.
Exactly. And I wanted to ask you if you were to take from where we are today and you know, that ideal stage where it will happen in a kind of a flawless way. And I also want to bring into the conversation the recent acquisitions that you've made. I mean, you've made a lot of acquisitions, and just in the last 1 or 2 years, you've acquired, I think, Container Chain, which is a custom solution provider. You've acquired Sistema, which is from Sweden as well, also for on the customs and logistics side. Cargo IT, I think it was a parcel shipping solution. I'm just wondering, and I wanted to ask you also, what's your strategy around these acquisitions? I mean, I'm guessing, and it makes sense that it kind of falls into that ideal image that you want CargoWise to get to. But if you can tell us a little bit more about how you plan to integrate all of this.
Well, most of those, with the exception of the Container Chain, is very recent. It's, by the way, it's landside logistics and empty container park management, not customs.
Okay.
But Cargo IT is customs, and Sistema is customs. And if you look at a world map, those fragments we talked about before are also represented by the fact that every country in the world has borders, and those borders have electronic customs on the import and on the export side, and various other customs procedures around the borders. And those are almost all of them are electronic, and almost all of them are different. So even in the EU, which is supposed to have a standardized customs system, a thing called the Single Administrative Document and a standard across the EU, remarkably, every country in the EU has its own independent customs systems, and they implement differently. And so it's not possible to have a single system. Well, it's not easily achievable to have a single system that processes entries in all countries. And that's been an enormous pain point for the big beneficial cargo owners, the big self-reporters, the authorized economic operators, trusted traders, and so forth. And it's also been very, very complex and painful and expensive for integrated forwarding groups that provide the export and import services as well as the cargo movement. And because we've become very strong in the forwarding area, and because as part of that we recognize that the pain of the customs processes needs to be resolved, we have been building out a global customs capability one country at a time. And we did all of the English-speaking world virtually by ourselves, and we were able to read the documents, talk to the customs officers, speak to customers, and do the engineering and the technical things required to make that work. But you then go to a non-English-speaking country, whether it's France or Germany or Brazil, these are very opaque. You can't read the documents because there are multiple languages involved and we're not expert in those languages. And we don't have anybody on the ground. We don't have any customers in the in those markets. And we don't really understand who in the customs management is people to talk to. And we couldn't read the documents anyway. So we have been acquiring a number of customs providers. These are people who are a very small version of what WiseTech is. There's been about, I'm going to say about 32 acquisitions over the course of the last 3 or so years. All of them are integrated in the traditional sense of the word integrated, but there's a lot to do. And most of them are quite small businesses as well. I mean, Cargo Chain was reasonably sizable, the revenue about $14.4 million Australian dollars, but most of them are quite small. And interestingly, all of those acquisitions came with their founders. All of those acquisitions retained the founders and all the team. There was no cost cutting or reduction of facility when we bought them. And in fact, we have repurposed their efforts, but those founders were paid typically about half the money up front, and they are on earnout to deliver an integrated system that is a part of CargoWise One and on modern, you know, high-class technology, and to convert the customers onto that platform so that the customers get the access to the entire CargoWise system. Now, that whole strategy is called Foothold, and it gives us a foothold in each country that we've invested in a customs vendor, and it gives us staff on the ground, customers in the ground, talent, knowledge, facility and capability, sales staff, access to the various government agencies that we need so we can comply with taxation for our customers, comply with customs procedures for our customers, and provide a platform which is increasingly highly globalized in terms of customs procedures. Now, that foothold strategy is added to by another strategy called adjacency, which is about extending past the borders. We've been very strong across the international supply chain and at the borders and just inside the borders. And now we're pushing into domestic transport and the land, what's called landside logistics that comes out of the terminal operators or stevedores to the pickup and delivery of containers at the export and import points to make that a much more digitized and electronic process. And a number of the acquisitions in that 32 were about those add-on adjacencies. Again, they are converting the software to an integrated CargoWise stack, and that creates an enormous amount more consistency. So we can do with it within the execution platform, the platform used by forwarders and 3PLs and carriers and trucking companies and other 2PLs, asset-heavy providers, they can do straight-through processing. But then you come to the end of that and you realize that there's another community, the community of beneficial cargo owners, importers, exporters, freight users that are also disconnected and fragmented and need to be a part of the model. And so that's why you may have seen recently we announced the creation of our companion product called CargoWise Nexus.
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, this process will take you many, many years to complete, but you're getting closer and closer to that platform one-stop solution or aiming for that, as far as I understand it, as far as you're describing it, which can provide your clients access to basically, you know, so that they don't need to go anywhere else and that they can do it all throughout your platform. And I also wanted to kind of ask you, because there's a lot of discussions around digital freight forwarding, and there was a very specific question from one of our audience who was wondering if you're going to add a digital solution which would enable small and medium-sized forwarders to compete with the bigger ones in terms of digitalization.
Well, I don't think any freight forwarders that are in existence today are truly digitalized or digitized. They have, if they've got CargoWise One, they've probably got the most digital straight-through process on the planet, and we've worked extremely hard to make sure that it is that process and it's straight-through. Very data-driven, not document-driven. But we already provide small freight forwarders with access to the same capabilities that DHL and DSV and many of our other large customers have. And we don't differentiate between them. We actually treat them very similarly. And they actually have access to all the components and all the capabilities of any freight forwarder. You know, I think that's an important thing here. We serve the entire supply chain. We serve all of logistics. And we're there to make the entire process a straight-through digital process, not a little fragment over here digital and then a little fragment over there, because when you do that, you end up with broken pieces that don't connect properly.
Understood. And that's a good clarification. I wanted to also bring into discussion a little bit, because you know, you were talking about very large players, you're talking about small and medium players, and I know that some very large companies have already tried spending a lot of money to create their own internal platforms. There's been a lot of some failures around it, and I know that WiseTech is spending more or less I think $100 million this year on research and development. And I'd like to touch a little bit about R&D. How do you think about R&D? How do you make sure that basically your product remains relevant, that your R&D money is well spent? Are there some principles around it that you put into the business?
Yeah, well, definitely. You don't go at something with $100 million and just sort of throw it up and say, who wants to build something? You actually think about the plan. There's a clear roadmap in our company, and I have a lot to do with that roadmap. And because I had to envision the first really joined up system right back in the beginning of the 90s when I started building that, and because I coded it and because I understand the culture of a software company, as a software engineer and as somebody that's written a lot of code myself, I don't write that code anymore. But nonetheless, I've got an extremely good relationship with the technical teams. I do a lot of work around how we hire, who we hire, how we train, how we develop, how we qualify people, how we ensure that workflow is done well. It's not a one thing. There's a whole culture. We actually call it the WiseTech way internally. It's about being very different to the established old ideas of waterfall development and, you know, big design and big build. And we're very iterative. We're very agile. We have a number of cultural elements inside. We have a fusion of people from the industry, which we call them product managers or product specialists. We have people who are technical leads in the teams with those product specialists. Product managers, we have developers in those teams, and they sit side by side so they can talk to each other. And we break the product up into teams, and the teams are centered around capabilities within the product. And then there's another layer which allows the interconnection of all the product components. That's the straight through processing thing I was talking about before. And if you've done that for 25 years, you've developed quite a bit of sophistication and subtlety around it. And we even went to the extent of building into our product and using that product. By the way, we use the CargoWise One to run our whole company. Mm. So we built a productivity tool called PAVE, Productivity Acceleration and Visualization Engine. Without that, we would not have been able to scale the company. We use it as a fundamental of the management of the person, the work items, the tasks, the team, the roadmap, and the whole company. And I can literally click on a computer screen and see any team in the world, any staff member in the world, any work item in the world, any task in the world. No, I don't look at all those things. I've got a lot of work to do. But that means that everybody has visibility of everything. And then you build a culture around quality and around efficiency and effectiveness. And you blend that into the sort of both the cultural part of things and also into the engineering dynamic that teaches us to be extremely efficient at things and to build tools like our Universal Customs Engine, like Glow, the designer tool for application development, and other things that actually take a lot of the work out and make it really fast to do software development. So when you look at a large company spending hundreds of millions of dollars on software, you realize they're using the lowest common denominator strategies. And we, with a good reputation like we have, listed public company, staff who all get shares as part of their compensation, a strong track record of quality, of learning, of teaching, of a culture of a real software company. If anybody wants to do this from your listeners, if you read our credo, you will see why people want to be part of WiseTech. We really do care about those people. We care about what we're building. We care about solving problems. We care about changing the world. as we say, one innovation at a time. And when you get all that together and you keep pushing it, you keep fighting to be better and to be higher quality and to be, to do things that other people just can't reach because they're too busy fighting fires, and you have a clean, highly developed, highly efficient culture that delivers high quality software at speed and at record low costs comparatively, you tend to accelerate away from everybody else. And you solve problems other people can't solve, and you don't fail like these big projects fail.
Yes. And I love your emphasis, and because a lot of times we talk about R&D, but I love how you linked it back to the culture and fostering that culture of innovation and creativity. And I will have a lot of questions around that. A lot of our listeners were curious about that. But just before we go into that, I wanted to loop back into, and you mentioned you're listed on the Australian Stock Exchange, and I wanted to just get your story and your thoughts of why you also did that, because that was a very strategic decision. You could have listed, obviously, on the NASDAQ Stock Exchange, and you didn't. You chose to list on the Australian Stock Exchange. I think you even said that you did that against the advice of everyone, and basically that was the best advice that you ever ignored in your career. So tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, so I think it's a couple of different things. The first is, you have to be true to who you are and not pretend to be somebody else. And so running off to the NASDAQ, look, it might be good for some companies, and I wouldn't criticize somebody for doing it. But for us, it seemed like an abrogation of our fundamental principles and our fundamental truths that is in the company. And from an effectiveness and efficiency point of view, it meant that we were actually able to stay in our hometown, in our home market, and talk to the cornerstone of our investors, and we do have obviously investors in Asia and the US and the UK and other places, but our core investment is here and our core people are here. And we were just being true to where we grew up and what we did. And there's this Australian culture, there's a kind of a cringe mentality about you have to go overseas to be successful. And I just think it's wrong. Doesn't actually work that way. And it makes it very hard when you rip yourself out from your roots and you go and stand somewhere else in a foreign land, in a foreign market with foreign things all around you, and you don't understand any of them. Your accent's a bit different and you don't understand the local regulations. I just chose a very efficient model. And at the time, people were saying, you'll get a better price than NASDAQ. It'll be, all these things will be better. But what actually happens, what has happened in the last sort of 5 years is that markets are now completely transparent, they're completely electronic, and anybody that sees a good company, they don't really care what market it's on, they care what the company is, and if they can use that market, because it's all electronic and all visible globally, it's not about being on the NASDAQ or being on the London Stock Exchange or being on the New York Stock Exchange. It's about being a great company and showing the market that you can say what you're going to do as a company and then do what you said. And if you keep doing that, people trust you, they come to you, they realize that you're doing something different and better, you're a very long-term view and the growth of the company is very powerful and valuable, and that's why people want to invest in WiseTech. They want to invest in WiseTech. We did what we said we were going to do, and we continue to say we are changing the world one innovation at a time.
Very well said. And to the point that you made with staying true to yourself and sticking to who you are at the core and being an Australian groomed company, there is actually a big success story in there, because there's not so many that have done so well and been run and continue to be run out of Australia. So we also got this question, which is an excellent question, is around what are the crucial steps that you took in terms of growing the company, the logistics technology company, from Australia into a global player? If there's certain success, again, I'm going to the principles because there's a lot of listeners that are entrepreneurs or they're running their own businesses. So if you can share certain success principles maybe that you followed in order to be able to become the global player that you are and still run the company from Australia.
Well, it's not one thing. It's a large and sophisticated pattern. But again, I think I'd refer people to our credo because it gives some breadcrumbs about what we did and why we do and why we do it. But also I think that we started and continue to be people that are systems thinkers. So I don't really look at something and go, oh, that's interesting. I look at it and go, why is that? I look at the, and I encourage this in all of the people in the company and even in our customers. I encourage people to be curious, to ask questions, to really try to understand what's going on and why it's going on. And that's painful sometimes because people really don't want you to ask because it's like, oh, why do I have to explain? But when you actually do that, you get much more information than you've otherwise got. The next thing, there's a quality that I really try to foster in myself, and I've always really had this. I have a healthy disrespect for the status quo. The way things are in the world, I look at them and I go, oh, surely that can't be right. Surely we can do better than that. Surely that's not the way that we should be doing things. And that's a good thing. It's a pain in the ass to do that all the time because it means you're never satisfied with it. Really good thing for business, a really good thing for problem solving. It's a really good thing to grow a great company because you're always challenging the status quo and that makes it better. The third thing I think of, is you need passion. You need power to drive yourself. And that passion is very important. It's not a management strategy. It's the drive to do things. And you also need a grit or resilience so that when you do get a knock, when you do get whacked for something, that you can stand up and dust yourself off and say, right, I learned from that. I will continue forward and I will do better next time. And those things together are probably the more fundamental things. Anybody with those attributes can learn management strategy, can teach themselves new things, can evolve and enhance themselves far better than somebody who doesn't have those attributes and wants to go to. You could have a Harvard education and extraordinary opportunity and still fail without those attributes, and you could have none of those things. As long as you had those attributes, you would probably succeed.
Mm. So it's interesting that we're looping back to the part with culture, right? So it's
right.
And with the part with fundamental soft skills at the end of the day and fundamental attitudes to foster within the team and within the company that makes it successful. And since we're at that, let's come back to that culture piece. And I'd love to get a little bit, if maybe the term is tactical or very example focused, if you can share with us and with the listeners, because fostering that culture of passion, innovation, grit. Let's not take status quo for what it is, and let's continue to innovate. You are an entrepreneur at heart. You've done so many things. You're the CEO of the company. But how do you translate that and cascade that down? I mean, I don't know how many staff you have today. There's a few hundreds of them, if not thousands of them. How do you ensure that it gets cascaded down to your managers, to your senior leaders? And maybe some examples of how you put this principles, if you may, into action.
That's a very good question, and actually, it has a couple of different layers to the answer. The first is, you shouldn't manage people; you should manage yourself and lead people. So, leading by example is a very powerful way of demonstrating the right thing to do. I'm a hard worker. I focus on important things. I challenge people to do better. I look at the problems that they've got and I work with people to help them. I often, use that as a part of the sort of guidance, the leadership that you need to have. But we also have a number of sayings within the company. And those are sayings that are kind of the mantras, the sort of global truth, the universal truths, if you will. I'll give you a couple of them. So one of them that follows directly from that leadership is we say to people, lead with content. What that means is if you're going to teach people something or tell them how to do something or give them guidance, standing up and saying things to a crowd will very quickly turn into a repeated and distorted answer. If you put it in writing or in a video and you publish it on the internal internet or you publish it publicly, if it's a public document, then I think that that's very, very powerful as a repetitive, reproducible, replicable thing. And I think that at the end of the day, those sort of tools, just that one tool is enormously powerful, but there's a couple more. Another one is anybody can talk to anybody at any time for any reason. That's there to flatten management and stop people bringing other management practices in to the business when what you're really trying to do is to, when anybody, we're growing, so we always have new people coming in, we have to make sure they know that it's not like it was when they were at XYZ industrial company. When you come to WiseTech, you join WiseTech to become like WiseTech. We talk about other little characteristics. We say slower today, faster forever. It means you should build the technology and the tools so that you can be very efficient and effective in the future and not just sort of rush it out, you know, make it work, but don't think about how to be making it another 100 times. And that's a really powerful idea. You know, there's a fundamental set of these universal truths. I won't call all of them out to you because there's a pretty reasonable list, but they are sort of guidance about the right thing to do, the right way to behave, and we've added to them. Just recently, we added another fundamental, a universal truth, and this is a very simple thing to say. What I'm about to say, but it was profoundly powerful to tell everybody that this is true. We said, delivery beats everything. You know, live beats everything. So if you can't make it work, if you can't get it done, sort of doesn't matter. And I was using that because people were saying, oh, maybe it's, you know, maybe we can't do this in time. Maybe we can't, maybe we should do it slower. Maybe we should investigate, you know, whether we should do it this fast. It's like, okay, this is important. We've got to do it. Delivery beats everything. Let's just do it. And it worked. Because you can bring the people, that's a call to action. People stand up and they go, right, I know what my mission is now. And they get out and they do it and they deliver it and they're standing proud saying, look at what I did. Look at what we did.
Yes. Like you said, I mean, all this is fundamentals, and I love the examples, and a very good one with the content one in terms of putting or lead by content, because it makes it it makes it very clear, and then people can revisit it. That's a very good one. And then thinking long term, of course, is a huge one, and a lot of companies really, especially in today's economic situation, they really don't think long term. So I love that one as well. Slower. How was it framed?
Slower today, faster forever. Now that doesn't refer to thinking long term. That refers to building. Well, I suppose it is thinking long term. Actually, when you look at it, what we're saying is, if you build something, build it so the next time you have to build something similar, it's much faster to do because you've built the architecture or tooling or the templates or the skills or whatever it is that you need to build, so that next time you don't have to build that, you just have to execute that. Yes. And we've done that across the whole company on lots of different things. And that's why that 100 million that we spend is so much more efficient than anybody else in the marketplace, because we've spent years and years and years pushing down on defect rates, pushing up on development performance, building the right things the right way, making sure that when we have to invest to make something better, that we do it. And that's this slower today, faster forever. It really means that you've got to do it right so that it's much faster in the future.
Yes. Again, fundamentals, right? Build the right foundation, and then in the future it will be, you can reuse it. Really good sharing. And I wanted to, because you had, I'd love to also look back with the acquisitions, because there's an element, there's a big element of culture in there as well. And I like how you mentioned that you keep the team, you keep the founders, which is incredibly powerful. Obviously, there is a subculture, there is a culture of those organizations that come into a WiseTech group. How do you integrate the culture of WiseTech with all the microcultures of all these organizations that you have acquired over time?
So, but let's look at what we're doing. So, first of all, we select carefully when we do acquire these businesses, and oftentimes the businesses were not for sale. Most of them, in fact, were not for sale. They're not on the market. They weren't represented by a business broker. And when they saw WiseTech, they in the early part of our listing, after listing, they hadn't heard of us. But these days, almost every one of those people has heard of us, and they are thinking, what's going on? What's WiseTech growing at 50% per year? on numbers that are 10 times my size. How do they do that? And they're very curious about what's going on. What, you know, they want to be part of it. And most of those founders saw what they saw and went, oh, I really want to be that. I've been landlocked in one country for the last 20 years, or I've been stuck in a marketplace that I just can't quite break out of. I can't get my growth up. How are you doing it, WiseTech? And we have a kind of a whole set of these tools that we use to show them how it is possible to develop themselves and develop their staff and to do much better with what they were. And we actually say, look, you've never seen us buy a company and strip the costs. We buy a company and grow the costs. We grow the business. We make it a much more successful business.
Yes. Oh, it's fascinating. Because it's almost like you don't need then to integrate any culture, because you're attracting similar types of cultures to you, and you're attracting similar types of organizations with the similar types of individuals.
That's true. I didn't mention that. But the people that we're talking to, we've chosen. And that they've chosen us. And even if there are micro differences between the cultures, these are smaller companies, and so they tend to have a flatter organization, and they tend to be more willing to adapt and adopt. And when they come, we put some considerable time into explaining and teaching them the thinking behind WiseTech. In fact, we put almost all of these people very quickly through a boot camp, an 8-day intensive called a Black Belt in Thinking. And it has all the WiseTech logic built into it. It's all the things that we do differently and why those things are the correct things to do.
Black Belt in Thinking. Wow. It's super. And I'd love to, we do a lot of, and my background is in human resources, in executive search, in developing talent. I'd love also to ask you, over time, I'm sure you've groomed a lot of talent within the company as you've grown. You're keeping your founders, you're keeping the people that you acquire, which is great. But I'm sure that at some points you've had to recruit externally and attract the talent from outside. How? I mean, maybe we start with what's the most challenging part in terms of finding the right talent from externally, and then how do you make sure they would fit well with WiseTech?
Well, so the first thing is that we recruit probably 10 plus people a month across the business, because it's very high. The business is not growing through acquisitions. That's a small part of the growth. We are growing organically because we have great products and the access to marketplaces that are very large, and we've got a very strong commercial offer. And so we need good people all the time. And if you're going to recruit 10 people, probably of those 10, 7 are in development, in software development, product management. And when you do that, you recognize that the fundamental problem that we've got is what we colloquially call the war for talent. We're looking to hire the most talented people, the smartest, the brightest, the most sophisticated, the most experienced, if possible, certainly university graduates and undergraduates, but also mature, experienced, senior people. And you don't do that by just putting an ad in the local paper or on the local recruitment site. You've got to actively go out and find people. You've got to track them with a job which is interesting and exciting for them, that fits their desires. You've got to ensure that you develop them when they arrive, that you give them a reason to stay at the company and want to be a part of the long term. You've got to really create an ecosystem of growth within the business. And if you do that and you keep working at it and you focus on talent and not on headcount, which is a term that I dislike quite a lot, then I think you have an opportunity to really, really hire exceptional people. And the only way you can have an exceptional business is to have exceptional people. There is no way to have an exceptional business with less than exceptional people.
And talking about these exceptional people, and there are obviously different layers, and I'd love to talk about your senior leadership team and people that report directly to you. And you did say that the organization is very flat, and that there's a big, big merit in that. But if we had to take the senior leaders within the organization, I'd love for you to share some of the key attributes or what's your kind of expectations from them? I mean, what's sort of you have a very strong manifesto, you have a very strong credo. I'm suspecting that you want them to live and breathe it. But I just wondered if there's some additional things that may come to you to share in terms of, okay, these are my kind of top expectations from my senior management in the company.
Sure. Well, there's quite a few layers. Sorry, there's not many layers in the management, but there's quite a few parts of that discussion. So, for instance, you need obviously people with financial skills. You need people with product skills. You need people with management skills. They're not necessarily all in the same package. You certainly don't want everybody to be just like you. And you don't want everybody to agree with everything you've said. In fact, challenging me is actually quite fun. I do like an intellectual argument about something. I don't want people to be critical of each other. I want people to be challenging of the ideas. You know, you need to be to be able to ask questions and challenge things, right? But obviously, there's the face of the company is a number of people. My CTO Brett's been with me for 25 years.
25 years.
My co-founder has been with me since much longer than that. That's Marie. Gail, who's our chief growth officer, she brings an enormous set of talents, and she is extraordinary in many respects. Obviously have to have a broader management team than that. But if I mention everybody, because it's very flat, I'll be mentioning 30 or 40 people. I interact with, on a daily basis, probably 10 people at least, and possibly across a month, probably 30, 40, 50 people. I sit in a couple of meetings each week. One, for instance, is a senior leadership meeting, which has got about 10 people in it on a Tuesday. There's a different group on a Thursday, but it's similar senior managers. And I have a product development meeting every second Wednesday. And then I will meet with individual people on individual issues and on the projects that I'm pushing forward, and also meet with the manager directors of the subsidiaries we've acquired. Gail and I will often do investor meetings and market issues, and we'll talk about various other growth mechanisms. So it's not something it's not patterned as a hierarchy. It's patterned as a collective, sort of almost like a hive mentality. You come together at the right times for the right places, and I'm very comfortable people coming at me from any part of the business. I mean, just a simple thing to reference to. We try to hire receptionists that are very smart, as in, cognitively powerful, and have an opportunity to grow so that we'll actually promote them out of reception. And it's remarkable that many of the people we've had in reception are now in administrative roles or in junior management roles now, instead of just stuck on reception for 5 years and then leave. And I have a view that everybody that comes in needs to be developed, needs to be able to grow, and need to be offered the ability to develop. You can't force people to develop themselves, of course. I'm a live and let live kind of guy, but ultimately that's a very powerful idea that people need to be and want to develop themselves, grow, learn and improve, and challenge where they were to go somewhere better. And you, by the way, even if you help people learn, if you educate them and if you develop their skills and they become very experienced, you actually have to pay them for the experience that you helped deliver. So I actually had a very sometimes shocking, maybe humorous experience with a couple of customers who've said to me, I don't really like training my staff because when I train them, they leave. And I reversed that. I said, well, the problem is that when you don't train them, they stay.
Yes.
And if you think about how terrible that sounds, you have an obligation to lift your people. You have the obligation to develop everybody. Even outside the company, we do a lot of work with high schools, with the Australian Computer Society, with the Sydney University, UTS, to help young adults and and people in high school and even right back into primary school to try to find their way into technology careers and into logistics careers.
Yes. Oh, I love the quote, and I think it there's so much meaning and so much purpose into it, because people will stay where they feel that they're being developed and taken care of. And just a couple of we're drawing towards the near of the end of this the interview, and just a couple of more questions, because I'd love also to flip it a little bit in terms of hiring, and I like to ask this question specifically. Maybe you can share with us in your 25-year career building the company, really, also what were some of your mistakes when it came to hiring people?
Oh, so look, I don't think no one has even close to perfect track record in hiring people. It's a very complicated problem.
Yes.
And it's the truly best way to hire someone is already have them and measure them on the job. That's the only way you can really measure someone's ability and someone's commitment and someone's drive. We do cognitive testing. We do personality testing, some psychometric testing. We do behavioral interviewing. And when we place somebody in their initial period, we put them through a number of experiences and measure those experiences very closely. But no, the best hiring in the world is maybe a 90% success rate, maybe a little bit less than that. And at the end of the day, I actually take I put a lot of importance on the idea that you have to own up when you didn't hire the right person. You've got to tell them the truth, and you've got to help them to understand that they're not suitable for the company. And you have to do that with empathy, but you have to do it.
Yes.
So the mistakes have been to not do that, to not move somebody on when they're not going to cut it, and to not be honest and truthful with people about the performance. It doesn't have to be a criticism of the person. It has to be honest about the performance itself and about what you require for people to be a good long-term employee. Most people, not everybody, but most people want to be a great employee. They want to be part of a good team. They want to be part of a great company. But that's not true universally. And ultimately, there are people that just want to come in and find a soft spot to sleep. And that can't be how it works in a great company. You have to move them on. And you have to make every effort to not hire them in the first place. But ultimately, it's an imperfect system.
And Richard, I was just wondering also, because the industry in particular, and I think diversity and gender diversity and gender balance in the industry, maybe technology or logistics is quite disproportionate a little bit. I'd love also to pick your views in terms of what you think about that, what you're doing at WiseTech, and how do you see it for the long run? I mean, how can we balance it a little bit better?
Well, the first thing I don't see it as a gender imbalance. I see it as a fundamental engineering problem. That is, we are missing a very large part of the talent pool who are female and who probably in technology particularly chose in early high school to move into a career or a subject set that wasn't a technology subject set. And you can see that. You can see, you know, parents and grandparents almost create this cultural split. They talk to their young children. They say, oh, girls do this and boys do that. I describe it as the trucks and dolls problem, you know. And it's a social issue as much as anything else. Now, we've been very lucky. We very much focus on getting the best people. And if you always choose the best people, you almost accidentally do better balancing your male-female population in your company. But it's impossible to balance it completely because the resource set that is talented female are moving off into other things. They're becoming flight attendants, or they're working in a law firm, or they're going into accounting, and they're not going into technology. And that is a terrible loss for them, because technology is a very well-paid industry, and it's a terrible loss for us because we need the best talent. You know, it's not just gender diversity. It's also the idea that people different to you actually offer something of value. It doesn't matter whether you come from Australia or the US or the Ukraine or Japan or Indonesia or, you know, I don't know, Brazil. It's not important where you came from. It's what you bring to us that matters. And so all those differences become positives because, you know, a hybrid culture is a very, very strong culture. You get this crossbreed strength out of a culture like that.
And final question, because we have a lot of also young people, people from the logistics, from the supply chain side, people from the technology side, and they've been curious in terms of what should they be learning, what should they be focusing, what kind of skills should they be acquiring in the next 5 years in this, you know, forever changing world. What would be your advice in terms of, you know, this younger population?
Well, I think the first thing you always have to do, you have to start from some basics like this, you know, passion and curiosity and so forth. But ultimately, if you can learn to teach yourself things, if you can learn to be curious and research what you need to know and find out how to do that yourself and not expect development to come to you by itself or to you to be taught by somebody who just turns up and tells you, but that you want to find a way of growing yourself. If you do that, people will also help you grow. And you have to recognize that going forward, low-skilled jobs, low-value jobs, low-paying jobs, in fact, are the ones that are all at risk. If you're a data entry operator, you need to be very afraid. If you are someone who is doing a job which is easily replaceable with automation, you need to be very afraid. If you're a person who is developing their skills, their knowledge, their talents, their value to a company, and if you care to help and you care to pitch in when there's a need and you care to want to grow yourself and grow your talents and grow the people around you particularly, then you are incredibly valuable and you'll be easy to retain and there'll be a job for you in the future. And I think that's the fundamental thing here, is that we need to be willing to help each other. We need to be able to build a depth in how we treat people and how we lift people. I mean, we're building a full training organization. We already have a very comprehensive training program for our customers, staff, and our partners, consultants. But we're going further. We're going to be teaching the whole of logistics. And I think we've got a very profoundly strong learner management platform. But we intend to make that a much bigger thing and a much broader thing. We'll even go into the technology side and help people learn in high school and even earlier. But ultimately, smart people, valuable people, are people that can learn and grow and improve and help other people learn and grow and improve.
Yeah, valuable piece of advice. Richard, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for the time. Thank you for the sharings. Thank you for teaching us some of the, or sharing with us some of the secrets and the principles of success at WiseTech. I'm sure you will continue to do great. I mean, it's just mind-blowing, actually. We haven't really touched upon this today, but, you know, you're 50% up year on year almost. It's just incredibly successful what you've managed to build, and I'm sure you will continue to build it. So good luck, and it's been a pleasure to have you as our guest.
It was an absolute pleasure to talk to you, and it was very interesting getting through those things and understanding them so I could express them well to you. That was fun too.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on radopalamario.com/podcast for all the show notes, links, and extra tips covered in the interview. Make sure also to subscribe to our emailing list to get the news in the nick of time. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes or Stitcher and you like what we do, please kindly review and give us 5 stars so we can keep the energy flowing and get more people to find out about our podcast. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me to stay tuned for our latest articles as well as future guests for the podcast. And if you have any suggestions or any other idea, please feel free to write to me. I respond to all. And also, please make sure not to miss our next episode, where we will be having a few other C-level and top leaders in supply chain joining us. Stay tuned.